I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order since it is 9:46. We do not yet have a quorum, but we can at least begin with testimony out of respect for members' time. My sheet away. Okay, so the first bill on the agenda is House File 973, Representative Purcell. Welcome to the committee. If you could please describe House File 973 for us, I will wait for a quorum to make the motion to move it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 973 is a reasonably straightforward bill that would reinstate the Citizens Board at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And as you can read in the legislation, there's a little bit of history there. The MPCA Citizen Board was created in 1967, and we obviously had assigned great value to having citizens involved in some of these decisions regarding the environmental quality of the state of Minnesota. And it's my firm belief that we need to go back to that part of the process. I'm not gonna go through line by line, but we certainly can take questions. I do have a couple of justifiers, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Thank you for the description, Representative Purcell. I know your testifiers have, some of your testifiers have come a ways too, so I want to make sure we get them. Welcome to the committee. We do have a fairly full agenda, so I'll ask you to try to limit your testimony to a few minutes. I do appreciate you coming here. So if you could please just start by saying your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today. My name is Jim Riddle, 31762 Wiscoway Ridge Road, Winona, Minnesota. I farm. My wife and I have an operation called Blue Fruit Farm. We raise blueberries and all sorts of unusual blue fruits. And I served on the MPCA Citizen Board in the past. I've also served on other both state and federal advisory boards and committees. I currently chair the state's Organic Advisory Task Force, and I see there's a bill coming before you today about the reauthorization of that task force. I'm happy to answer any questions when that comes up, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the task force. My remarks are made on my own behalf. I also served on the Minnesota's Water Quality Certification Program Committee and served on the USDA's National Organic Standards Board that helps establish the standards for organic products nationwide. But serving on the MPCA Citizen Board was very unique in that that board had statutory authority, and I served on that board just from 2013 to 2015. And I see that the language before you in House File 973 essentially reauthorizes both the composition, the appointment process, and the powers of that board. When I served on the board, we dealt with contested case hearings, EAW and EIS determinations, as well as providing input on things like changes to regulatory statutes, standards such as water quality. The members of the board took that position, their appointment, very seriously. We had monthly meetings with excellent background materials. We did our homework. We came prepared, and we represented the citizens of Minnesota. One thing that I think has been missing since the board was eliminated or disbanded was those monthly meetings. They gave a chance for the citizens of Minnesota to be heard. Yes, the board would ask questions, but the floor was also open and everything operated in the light of day. It was all fully transparent and democratic. We heard from the proposers, we heard from staff, and we heard from concerned citizens. And we don't have that kind of democratic, transparent process in place now. And one thing I found in serving on the board is the staff often has worked very closely with the proposers to help resolve the various issues. And so the staff naturally almost becomes an advocate for the project. They have invested a lot of their time, energy, into helping find answers for the proposers, but they needed to be held accountable. They needed to be asked tough questions, and that's exactly what the citizen board members did. To me, it was a incredible example of democracy in action. It provided a check on big government, on bureaucrats in St. Paul making decisions in a vacuum, especially for people from the rural area. It gave people in the rural area a voice in the composition of the board, but more importantly, the monthly meetings that were open to anyone with concerns to be able to have those concerns aired in a fair and transparent manner. So I just urge passage of House File 973 and restore good government to the MPCA and reinstate the citizen board. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Riddle. We are now at quorum, so I will officially call this meeting to order. And the could I have a motion to approve the minutes of the March 5th meeting, please? Representative Stock moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The minutes are adopted. So then, as welcome to the committee. Sorry about that little delay there. If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
You betcha. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dana Burtness. I'm a longtime Land Stewardship Project member, and I'm the co-owner of Nettle Valley Farm. My husband Nick and I raise pastured pigs near Spring Grove, Minnesota, in beautiful Houston County. We sell whole and half hogs directly to families and chefs, and we raise them using regenerative farming practices that are water quality and community friendly. I'm here to testify in support of House File 973, so thank you very much for having me here today. So I'm here to highlight the importance of the MPCA Citizens Board to the review process in Minnesota. Reinstating the MPCA Citizens Board would be a good first step towards recentering citizens, not industry, and special interests to the environmental review process. Right now, there's no meaningful way for Minnesotans to be engaged in the environmental review process when there's a concerning proposal in their community. Currently, submitting a comment or showing up at a public informational meeting does not guarantee MPCA action. Citizens need to be able to make sure our valuable information based on our local knowledge, our expertise, and our experience is heard and acted upon. We, the people, should be at the center of the environmental review process, not on the outside looking in and being shooed away. Reinstating the Citizens Board is crucial to have a transparent, accountable, open public process for environmental review. And I'm here because this is a really personal issue to me. Having the Citizens Board reinstated is extremely important to me and my neighbors. After a gigantic, risky factory hog farm was proposed in our neck of the woods last spring, my neighbors and I had to scramble to protect our water and property values and our way of life. We organized in good faith that the MPCA would actually follow environmental review law, not so much to ask. And order an EIS because the public record about this, the enormous potential for significant environmental impacts was crystal clear. It turns out we were being completely naive. Quickly, what did become clear to us was that the MPCA currently has the attitude that the industry is the customer, and their mission isn't to protect citizens and control pollution and follow the law, but their mission is to actually just do whatever it takes to facilitate smooth sailing for corporations who want to profit off putting our drinking water and our health at risk. Our expertise and local knowledge was disregarded by former Commissioner John Lakestein, and our concerns were never substantially addressed after the former commissioner pulled some really unfortunate, opaque administrative maneuvering that demonstrated the MPCA's commitment to bending over backwards to help industry instead of citizens who would be affected. To give an example of this, at a press conference, Commissioner Stein announced that he was denying the general Catalpa permit. Oh, but then his staff said, oh, no, no, no. He was actually just announcing his intention to deny the permit. Well, then we heard from Stein through a reporter that he officially submitted that paperwork and we should just ask the MPCA for it. But then Assistant Commissioner Lotthammer said that, oh, that paperwork doesn't exist. The factory farm proposer is going around our community telling people that and claiming that the permit was never officially denied. And now we have current Commissioner Laura Bishop saying it was denied, but you're just going to have to take our word for it on it because there's no paperwork to prove it. This is unacceptable to us, and it's frankly a mess. Our community still has no answers or documentation about these, let's just say it, shady maneuvers that were made behind closed doors and off the record. That's not the way the MPCA is supposed to work. With a citizens board, there would have been a clear public process to engage in. We appreciated former Commissioner John Lakestein's words in the public meetings, but his actions made it clear that he values the MPCA, or the MPCA values industry voices more than citizens. Commissioner Stein had a chance to do the right thing, and he punted. A citizens board would have created a formal space and a transparent process for citizens to be heard and respected without the pervasive influence that industry and special interests has directly on MPCA staff. We would have had access to this documentation around what actually happened with the proposal's denial and reapplication. We are still waiting for answers. So with the MPCA Citizens Board in place, that final crucial decision for me and my neighbors would have been made in public instead of in the shadows and off the record. So in closing, I urge you to support this bill and vote yes. And thank you very much, and I'm willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Burtness. Looks like there's another testifier coming up. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Myers, and I'm a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters, Minnesota. As you know, the League is not an environmental organization. Rather, we are a nonpartisan good government organization. Our mission is to encourage active and informed participation in government. Along with protecting the right of every citizen to vote, we support the right of these citizens to know what their government is doing and to participate in government decisions at all levels. Transparency and citizens' participation are top priorities. The MPCA Citizens Board, as it existed from 1967 to 2015, exemplified public access and involvement, transparency and citizen participation at its best. By abolishing the Citizens Board as it did, the 2015 legislature removed a critical balance to the MPCA's decision-making process, and it cast a shadow over this legislature. As the lead agency in protecting Minnesota's environment and Minnesotans' health, the MPCA is occasionally in the news in the midst of controversy. The Citizens Board met monthly, as you've heard, made often difficult decisions in a public setting. Members of the public attended and were able to testify before the board to share their views. In the 2015 session, there was no bill to eliminate the Citizens Board. There were no hearings, and no public testimony was taken before this open and transparent governmental board was abolished. It was abolished behind closed doors in the early morning hours of May 25th, the last day of the 2015 legislative session. This was done by a conference committee, which put the abolition in the must-pass omnibus environment finance bill. This was not an example of the representative democracy Minnesotans expect. On a personal note, I taught government to high school seniors for many years. It never occurred to me to present the idea that a small group of legislators in the middle of the night, adding significant bill language which had never seen the light of day to a must-pass omnibus bill on the last day of the session, was the way government should work in Minnesota. Protecting the environment is among the government's most important responsibilities to us and to our grandchildren. The League of Women Voters believes that the public has a right to view readily, to understand clearly, and to take part easily in decisions on important environmental questions. The abolition of the MPCA Citizens Board did not reflect the will of Minnesota's citizens, rural or metro. The League of Women Voters urges you to support House File 973 and reestablish the MPCA Citizens Board as an effective way to engage citizen participation in the important goal of protecting our environment. We also urge you to develop legislative procedures which do not allow this kind of late-night backroom lawmaking. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Myers. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the recent testimony forced me to go back and recall the multiple times that this was debated in public, in committees, and discussed, because frankly, I was there for some of that. So I wasn't, you know, reading some report. And I also, because I was around that time, recall the bipartisan support this had to limit the only entity that had such broad and expansive powers that was of this format. And that was the core of the debate. We debated and talked about legal activities going through the courts, other aspects, and why this was different than similar entities. And so therefore, bipartisanly, it was decided, and bipartisanly, it was voted and passed, and then was signed into law. So my memory is pretty clear, and frankly, I just want to make sure the members that weren't present during that time period are aware that it was not hidden. It was open. It was debated. It was public. And I guess I'm just shocked that people would try to make us believe that it was just two, three people. No. It was voted by the legislature and signed by the governor. And that's why it became law, not two or three people in a room. And I do believe that most conference committees are attended by the public. And the schedule is posted. That's a standard operating procedure. I don't recall the exact details of these because, yes, it was a busier time at the end. But the decision, the debate, and the activity started much sooner and was public.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I didn't hear a question there. So, Representative Zerwin.
Mr. Chair, you heard a statement to clarify something that came from the testifiers that was not factually based from my memory having served in this body during that period of time.
I wasn't disputing that. I just stated I didn't hear a question. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is important to point out that this was passed in a bipartisan fashion with the support and in some ways insistence of, at the time, Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach. And so I think there are some of us who may be a little upset that some folks might be under the impression that this was a Republican initiative or a Republican move. If I remember right, this passed in special session, and this was a part of the agreement that that Senator Bach struck in the Senate was to remove the Citizens Board if I recall correctly, Mr. Chair. And so I think that might be why there's a bit of a friction here. There was a lot of concern with what had been seen as pretty significant overreach by the Citizens Review Board, and really kind of an unchecked amount of power and authority that the board had, even over decisions of a state agency that made some question its role and validity, to have a kind of a state-appointed group of citizens that would overrule decisions by state employees in the agency. That was also one of the reasons that the board was discontinued. Mr. Chair, we would oppose this bill, and we would ask for a roll call vote on the bill.
Thank you for mentioning that. In the excitement of us obtaining a quorum and in the excitement of moving the minutes, I neglected to move the bill. So I will move that House File 973 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And Representative Zerwas has requested a roll call, so there will be one. I know this was included in an omnibus bill. I know there were instances where omnibus bills were kind of assembled without legislators knowing all of the details that went behind it. I don't remember exactly how it occurred in this scenario. I don't know, Ms. Myers, did you want to elaborate on that at all, or?
Just to say that I was there too, and there was at least one bill to curtail the Citizens Board, but there was not a bill to abolish it in my recollection, and I will certainly look into it further and let you know. But the first we knew of it was like a 2 o'clock a.m. conference committee.
Okay, thank you for that. I don't have any other members on the list. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing this forward too. And maybe yourself or one of the testifiers can answer this question. So what is the process in place right now for citizens to be heard if there are concerns with some of the different industries that may be in their community?
Representative Purcell?
Certainly there's a petition process in place with MPCA, and I'm not going to go on beyond what my knowledge base is, but there is a petition process, and I believe there's, you know, an effort to have public meetings. I'm going to stop there. And
I know we have, yes, there are representatives of
we have
the MPCA
lose control here.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Alexis Donath, and I'm from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I also am here with Jean Coleman, who is one of our staff attorneys. And the MPCA is taking a neutral position on this bill. We do support citizen engagement and participation, Representative Lee. Public comment and public meetings are a common occurrence for us, whether around permits, reports, or issues of concern like landfill cleanups and contamination sites. And we hold about four sessions like that each month, or about 50 per year altogether. And citizen engagement is one of Commissioner Laura Bishop's top concerns, and we have mechanisms in place such as the Environmental Justice Advisory Group, Tribal Consultation, the Environmental Quality Board, and many other types of public meetings and opportunities for public participation.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the PCA, then how often or how likely is it for you to, you know, engage with the community if there was a concern about a particular, industry or company that's in the community that they believe may have violated some of our pollution standards? And, you know, if we, Mr. Chair, I'm bringing this up because there's a particular industry in my community where there have been concerns and they feel like they have not had the proper response from the PCA. And, you know, in talking to a nonpartisan researcher, they had said that, you know, this is an issue that if the Citizens Board were not repealed in the past, that that's something that the Citizens Board could have looked over. And so I'm just curious to see what is your process now in addressing some of those concerns, and do you address everyone that's brought forth, or how do you go on about deciding which one to take up?
Ms. Donat.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the MPCA does hold public participation processes, open public comment periods, and public meetings for situations such as the situation you're referring to. When we hold a public comment period, it is our responsibility, and I'm looking to our lawyer, it is our responsibility to respond to each and every comment that is submitted to us.
Representative Lee?
Oh, Mr. Chair, and, you know, we heard some comments there, too. And, you know, for the members of the committee, you know, having this is really important. This is an environmental justice issue that's really important to, you know, the folks who live in districts like mine, where we have big industries who, you know, have been found to have polluted, violated some of our pollution laws, and not having the PCA really enforce some of that standards. And, you know, we just saw last week where there was a situation with Water Gremlin one of our Northeast Metro, and, you know, based off of the media reports, the community members are concerned that their voice are not being heard, and so that's why I feel like this is such a crucial bill for us to pass. This year, and Representative Purcell, I just want to say thank you for, you know, listening to the people of the state of Minnesota and addressing some of their concerns. You know, when we have companies out there who have knowingly violated and polluted in our community, so thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the author. Following the special session in which this board, the Environmental Citizens Review Board, was eliminated, the governor, through executive order, created a Citizens Board to collect just the type of input and comment that Representative Lee was talking about. Is that board still in existence? Is that board still meeting? Is that board still providing feedback and input to the department?
Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to defer to MPCA. I think they'll know that more intimately than I.
Sure. Ms. Donath.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the citizen advisory group that you are referring to met for a period of time under the Dayton administration. That group is no longer meeting at this time.
Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifier then. Is that because of lack of interest, or what is it that the administration changed so the new governor would need to issue a new executive order? What's the why?
Ms. Donath.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I do not have full information about the rationale behind that. I would defer to our attorney.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your answer.
Certainly. Thank you. My name is Jean Coleman. I am an attorney with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and as Representative Zerwas indicated, the Dayton administration created an advisory committee by executive order. It met consistently during the Dayton administration. The Walz administration is in consideration of whether or not they're going to re-up that executive order.
Representative Zerwas?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the MPCA was supportive of the bill and removal of the Citizens Review Board several years back. They are neutral on a bill to bring back the Citizens Review Board. And the new administration hasn't even re-upped an executive order for a Citizens Advisory Board to come together. So clearly this bill isn't a priority of the governor, isn't a priority of the commissioner, and isn't a priority of the MPCA.
Sounds like then it should be a priority of the legislature, Representative Zerwas. So, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question's for the author, Representative Purcell. Is it in fact true that the board would consist of the commissioner and then eight appointees political appointees by the governor?
That's my understanding.
Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, is it true that the board would make final decisions on significant agency actions, and they could, in fact, have the power to rescind or reverse a decision that was made by the agency? Is that true?
Representative Purcell.
That's my understanding.
Representative Heinrich.
Representative Purcell, why? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, why should political appointees, in your opinion, be given this tremendous power?
Because they're citizens of the state of Minnesota. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell.
Because they're citizens of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, you're elected by the citizens of the state of Minnesota. My concern here is just simply, and I think Senator Bach, Leader Bach, maybe at the time, not to speak for him, but I feel like he might have had some issue as well with the fact that it's just simply appointed people. So you have eight people that are appointed that can apparently override a decision made by the agency. It feels like a lot of power for a non-elected body. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Did a little bit of research because it's important to have the context of this bill, and you had mentioned it just a little bit ago that it had been probably dropped in somewhere along the way without people knowing. In researching it, the author in the Senate, and I know we don't usually give them a whole lot of credit for, you know, anything, that but was Senator Scoy, Senator Rosen, Senator Tomasoni, and Senator Saxog. So this was a bill that did this, and I believe that was the senator, one of the senators for Representative Purcell's district. So this was not, as everyone usually likes to say, dropped in the dark of night or in a smoky backroom deal. It was actually authored by DFL senators. And so I think that it's important to add that context so that this is actually something that is a bipartisan effort. Scoy, Rosen, Tomasoni, Saxog, people who don't always agree on everything, some fairly strong outliers, and that this was not something that was just sort of gently slipped in conference committee. This was an actual bill that made it all the way through the process, ultimately wind up being signed by the governor. So, you know, there's got to be a good reason that, you know, three DFL senators said, you know what, let's take this action. I think that it's an important thing to notice here in committee because it clearly was not dropped in the dark of night.
Yeah. Thank you for the clarification, Representative Nash.
Happy to help.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. And just to clarify here, I'm pretty sure Senator Rosen would not want to be addressed as a DFLer, as you did mention her earlier. She is, in fact, a Republican. Just wanted to make that clarification for the members. I think the point here is this. There seems to be a little bit of murkiness on how this came about. I'm not really sure where the truth lies, probably somewhere in the middle. But I will tell you that in my day job, one of the things that I do is I work with teams on how to get things done quickly, how to get them done efficiently, and most importantly, how to reach the goal. And one of the things that we talk about in my business is very often is that we try things, and we try to fail early and often. And when they fail, we need to take a good hard look at why they failed and how we improve that process. And what seems very clear to me from the testimony today here is that the process that we have isn't working. That we have citizens who are clearly going unheard, that for whatever mechanisms we have put in place, whatever meetings we may have scheduled or not scheduled, whatever process that we have, it's not working. It's not working for the citizens of Minnesota. It's not working for the people who it impacts most. And with that, in light of that information, it seems to me that the best course of action is to look for another solution. And so for that reason, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Purcell, and let you know that I would, in fact, be in support of this measure. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Bonner. I didn't hear Representative Nash implying Senator Rosen is a Democrat. I heard him mentioning her name as an example of how there were members of both parties, just for clarification on that, and hopefully to prevent him from speaking in. Again, I thought I would offer that clarification.
Are we quelching the voice of the minority here?
No. I just thought I'd...
I support him on this
one. Well, Mr. Chair, thanks for that clarification. And, yeah, I would never label Senator Rosen as a Democrat. The point was it was a very bipartisan effort, Representative Bonner, so I did not articulate what you said I did. So thanks for clarifying that, Mr. Chair.
No problem. Apparently it wasn't successful at my goal, though.
Well noted. Okay. Well noted.
All right. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've spent a lot of time on a number of different boards, and I've been responsible, in fact, for legislation that has changed the configuration of boards, and in particular looked at the constitutionality of different boards. And what I see here with the Citizens Board having the ability, appointed Citizens Board, having the ability to reverse actions of a state agency, boy, I don't know if this could be tested in court, but it seems as though this may be unconstitutional. The way our former government is set up is that legislators are elected by the public, and we turn then to our agencies to enact the laws that we make. And then it's our responsibility to oversee the actions of those agencies and to make changes if appropriate. My question, I do have a question in all of this, and my question is, what other state agency has a citizens board attached to it with this kind of power? Can anybody answer that question?
I don't know, Representative Purcell or House Research maybe? I do know that this board was in existence for how many years prior to its
67,
repeal?
67.
67 years, so I mean...
Well, since 1967.
Oh, since 1967, yes. So there is precedent, years. At least in this board. I don't know, Mr. Gehring, if you have any... Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, committee members, so there are a number of agencies that are governed by boards. I'm not sure that I have a specific example of one that's exactly structured like this, but Ms. Dyson and I were just confirming that the MHFA, the Housing Finance Authority agency, is governed by a board that has sort of a unique structure, and there are others as well. But as I said, I don't know that there's one specifically like this.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you for that. I understand that there's different governing boards that have different levels of power, but I guess I'd have to look at it further. I don't see any other agency that has a citizens board that's appointed that has this kind of power. And then secondly, boy, I would just like to ask Governor Walz if adding extra layers back into government is a way to be responsive and efficient. I have a really hard time adding back in a layer of government that makes our process even more inefficient. I'm from northeastern Minnesota, and I have witnessed projects that have come apart because of years of delay in permitting processes. And I have witnessed the Citizens Board of the MPCA being a part of that. So I would, on a couple of fronts, I would very much oppose reinstating the Citizens Board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. I don't have any additional members on the list. Okay, so Representative Purcell, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just offer that most of the discussion I heard here this morning has been in support of public participation in our government, and that's what this bill's about. Okay. Appreciate your support.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Purcell. There was a roll call requested, so the clerk will take the roll. I'll renew my motion to refer House File 973 to Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Pulowski.
Yes.
Representative Stout.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Lehman.
No.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
Okay. There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. Your bill is on its way to the Ways and Means Committee, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. And if you could stay up there, we have one more bill of yours.
I will do that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I will move that House File 1656 be recommended to be to pass and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Wait. Oh, okay. Is there a fiscal note requested on your bill, Representative Purcell? We don't actually have that here.
I'm confident there will be because there's some fees.
Okay, that sounds good. Then I will move that House File 1656 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So if you could please present your bill, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm looking for some DNR support here. This is a DNR bill, basically, that I'm carrying, and they do a much better job explaining all these provisions than I can do, but... And I will add that there are a couple of other bills that were amended into this. One particularly is in Section 11, amending dogs pursuing big game, and this is was a standalone bill that we put in here, and it is. Primarily intended for folks, for instance, that are colorblind, and when they say knock a deer down and they need to go find that deer, that they can't follow a blood trail, so they are using a dog to get on that deer and dispatch. So that's...
You've perked my interest. I have red green colorblindness. I don't hear that referenced very often.
I don't believe that it's labeled as such, but that was... At least a good part of the impetus for the bill.
Okay, and I understand that there are two rulemaking provisions in this bill, and that is primarily what's in the jurisdiction of this committee. So should I turn it over to your testifier, Representative Purcell?
Let's do that, and then we'll have our conversation, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Sure, and if you could focus on those provisions, that would probably be the most germane to this committee. That would be appreciated. And so just please state your name first and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Waters, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Excuse me.
Thank you.
So the statute provisions are not part of what the DNR put forward in our original bill, but as part of some of the amendments that were included on. So Section 21 in particular is changing some provisions of our stamp design, allowing for non-photographic digital media as a possible media for that entry. The DNR is currently neutral on the position and will take any guidance from the legislature as they see fit for this bill. And then regarding Section 14, regarding using 13 and 14, excuse me, regarding using dogs to help locate wounded deer or bear, the DNR is also neutral on this position. We've worked with the legislatures to get this the wording to a foreseeable means, and are neutral on the position as it is written.
Thank you, Mr. Waters. Could you go back to Section 3 of the bill, starting at line 2.9? I believe exempts the department from rulemaking in a certain circumstance there. It says on line 2.19 through 2.21, it says the procedures for grants and aid are not subject to the rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have somebody from Parks and Trails come help answer that question.
Sure, thank you. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Sure.
My name is Andrew Korsberg. I'm with the DNR Parks and Trails Division.
Okay.
This proposed change is basically a technical clarification. The Snowmobile Grant and Aid Program has been operated as a performance-based program for a number of years. The Grants Management Department of Admin's grant management policies have changed over time, and so we were recommended through internal review that we should make this technical clarification.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, is there member discussion? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell. I'm really happy to see the stamp provision in this bill, so thanks.
Thank you. Okay, seeing no member discussion, any closing remarks, Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think it's a good bill, so I appreciate support.
Okay. I will renew my motion that House File 1656 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way. Thank you for being
here. Thank you, Mr.
Chair and members. Okay. Yeah, who? Representative Zhang, are you still here? I saw you earlier. Okay. Welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1150 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. So if you could please present some testimony, and did I hear you say maybe we were going to present some treats as well?
Yes. You all worked so hard last time I was here, so I thought I'd bring some treats this time.
Okay, I did not. I told him not to, but he insisted, so...
And Representative Nash and I haven't gone out for our special bowl of foe yet, so I thought I'd bring this here.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Zhang. That is very decent of you. So while those are being handed out, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Before me, I have House File 1150, which is a bill that allows for the optional temporary appointment of a county commissioner until an election can be election can be held. Currently, if there is a county commissioner vacancy and there is more than 1 year remaining on the term, the vacancy is filled by a special election. Under current statutory election law, the provision themselves can create vacancies on the county board for nearly a year, leaving many constituents represented. And House File 1150 allows for the temporary appointment to fill these county commissioner positions and to fill a vacancy until a special election can be held. And with me is a testifier that can speak a little bit more to some of the details of this bill and the need for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jennifer Wiginius, and I'm the Director of Property Records and Taxpayer Services at Washington County. We appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill today. Washington County supports this House file. Washington County commissioners became aware of an issue several years ago when one of our commissioners became ill and suddenly passed away. When there is less than a year remaining on a vacant commissioner term, the board has the authority to appoint a commissioner until the election is held. In this case, there was more than 1 year remaining on the term, so a special election was required and was called. The special election was called in March, but could not be held before the general election cycle, leaving the position vacant until a new commissioner could be sworn in early in December. Depending on what time of year the vacancy occurs, as Representative Zhang indicated, that could leave a position open for almost a year when there is a special election required. These vacancies then leave a portion of the county population unrepresented, unreasonably burden our existing commissioners, and may leave the county at a disadvantage on decisions of financial and operational importance to our citizens. The Washington County Board does not disagree with the requirement to hold a special election. Rather, they are just asking for the opportunity to make a short-term appointment until the special election can be held in accordance with statutory election dates.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Wiginius.
And Mr. Chair, I think
there will be another testifier for this bill, too.
Okay, sure. Welcome. If you could please come down and identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'll try to be brief. My name is Matt Hilgart. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all 87 counties. And we'd like to thank the author and Washington County for leading on this bill and stand in full support. As one of the testifiers mentioned, county board agendas seem to be getting more and more complex. And if there is not full representation during these times, and especially during the time periods of budgets, levy decisions, etc., it's a real disadvantage for the district that's not represented. So we stand here in full support of this.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hilgart. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a point of information, maybe nonpartisan staff. There was an effort in the last legislative term to set, I believe it was like four dates so that we had set times for such special elections. And I'm not, I thought it passed the House. I thought it became law, but maybe some clarification.
Sure. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, yes, so I believe that was your bill originally, was enacted as part of the elections bill last year, so there are set uniform dates in statute now that would require special elections like this to be held on those dates, and there are four of them.
Okay. Representative Kwan?
Thank you. And the intent, Mr. Chair and members, was by having four dates across the calendar year, you limit the length of which it would be before the next special election, plus you decrease the cost because you would bundle things together. And so when they say could be up, you know, almost a year, I think it's considerably less with, you know, the new law passed. And I think it's just no more than 3 months and sometimes it's just a couple months between the dates.
Thank you, Representative Blum. Representative Zhang?
Thank you, Chair. I think Director Wilgenius can speak a little bit more to that.
Sure. Ms. Wilgenius.
Mr. Chair, members, I did look at the timing of this situation because this was before the special election law passed, and my role in Washington County is as the director of our election services as well. In this situation with a primary and then a general, it would still have fallen at the same election calendar with the final election in November and the seating in December for this situation.
Thank you. Is there additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Zhang?
Thank you for
I'm sorry, I'm sorry, Representative South might have
had a discrepancy in how this rolled out. And so if we have four dates in the calendar, then I find it
difficult to understand exactly where the conflict arose. So if you could just get me on board with what you explained as the challenge.
Representative Zhang?
Thank you, Chair. Director Wilgenius can speak.
Ms. Wilgenius.
Mr. Chair, members, there are certain number of days for the primary and then the regular election. So under those four election dates, with the timing of before and after the notice, the absentee voting of 46 days, the programming of the ballots, all the dates for a special election are supposed to be monitored or kept the same for counties. And so with those dates, working with our attorneys at Washington County, we reviewed the calendar, and that would have again led to we weren't able to meet the May date, so that led to a primary in August and then a general election in November.
Representative South.
Thank you. That explained the way the process didn't function like we might have thought it would.
Okay. Sure. Any additional member questions or comments? Representative Zhang?
Thank you, Chair, and I hope to receive your support for this bill from the committee. And I feel bad, and Representative Nash isn't here today, so.
I will renew my motion that House File 1150 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. So, Okay. Representative Long is not here yet, so I think Representative Lilly, would you be amenable? And I don't see Representative Hansen or Lippert either. Or Claflin? Actually, Representative Lilly, I apologize. Yeah, how about, since you're not on the committee and have been waiting patiently. So. Welcome to the committee, Representative Claflin. I will move that House File 1723 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. If you could please present your bill, Representative Claflin.
Thank you for that courtesy of letting us present the not on the committee. Mm-hmm. I am a member of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, along with Representative Juergens and Senators Sengem and Torres Ray. And the House File 1723 is just doing some operational changes to the function of this commission. We have a 15-member commission with five citizen members along the full length of the Mississippi River from the headwaters down to our border with Iowa. The commission also has sister commissions in other states going all the way down to the Gulf. And these changes would help us have some continuity and make the administration of elections a bit easier, and also help us work with the greater Mississippi River corridor. The first thing that the bill does is change the member terms from the current 2 years to 4 years, and it would be on staggered terms. This would help us with some continuity, some knowledge transfer between members, and it would also help with the administration of appointing those citizen members. The bill also repeals the sunset provision. It would be scheduled for sunset in 2020. And by repealing that, it would help with getting the long-term grants and helping fulfill our responsibilities to the other states along the Mississippi River. And finally, there's a technical change that MnDOT supports, which would remove the language saying that, let me get this correct. The role of the River Parkway Commission is to improve the Great River Road, which can include state trunk highway systems, but the appropriations fund for the trunk highways includes a statement that the Mississippi River Parkway Commission does not further a highway purpose and does not aid in the construction, improvement, or maintenance of the highway system. So delete that phrase. And with me today, I have Chris Miller, who is the director of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and Diane Henry Wagenstein, the Legislative Coordinating Commission Deputy Director.
Great. Are they both here to testify, or are they just here for questions?
Just for questions.
Okay, great. Is there anyone who would like to speak, testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I'm speaking in support of this bill. It's become relatively commonplace these days for parkway or bikeway projects to be constructed in conjunction with road projects at each level of government, and it sounds like we've now got a prohibition here that's standing in the way with respect to a very important state project. So I would urge members to vote for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any additional discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1723 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Your bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Clapp.
Thank you very much.
I saw Representative Long pop his head in, but then, okay. Oh, yeah, hey. Okay. Representative Long. I will move that House File 1644 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I also have an author's amendment.
Okay, thank you. I will move the A3 amendment. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like it?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay. All those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape you'd like. Representative Long, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to talk about the census today. Put simply, the stakes couldn't be any higher for Minnesota in 2020. Just as there were in 2010, we're right on the bubble again. And we literally kept the last seat up for grabs in 2010, the very last one, 435th. And we only did that because we had a strong census with the second highest response rate in the country. Right now, we are ranked 437th for our eighth seat. So that means there are two states ahead of us. Montana is 436th, and California is ranked 435th. The margin for whether we could keep a seat could be in the range of as few as 10,000 to 30,000 people. We've added 300,000 people since 2010 in our last census, but it may not be enough. We would lose representation in Congress, as clear. We would lose an electoral college vote, and this is not a Democratic or Republican seat. We don't know what this seat would be, and even beyond, if we did know the partisan identification, I don't think it should matter, because we have a delegation in Congress that is working extremely hard on our behalf, and there are many issues that are Minnesota issues and are not partisan issues that the delegation comes together on frequently. In addition to the representation that we would lose, over $8 billion in federal money is allocated to Minnesota based on the census, and this is from Medicare to school lunches to highway construction. Every uncounted resident costs the state $15,000 before the next census. So for perspective, looking at our neighbor, Wisconsin, in the 2010 census, there was an estimate that a 1% undercount for that state would have cost them $76 million in Medicaid funding. We also know that there are communities that under-respond, and historically undercounted groups are varied. It includes rural residents, it includes renters, it includes low-wealth communities, immigrants, highly mobile residents, it includes kids. There was a good profile in MinnPost about the undercounting of babies, which is a big issue. No offense to the baby in the room. And college students as well. So this bill would help support the work of the state demographer during this critical time and also establish a grant program to increase awareness about the census, to engage historically underserved communities, and to help recruit census workers. We know that there's, with the low unemployment rate, going to be a big challenge in making sure we get enough census workers. It would also assist census workers in gaining access to apartment buildings. So just to speak about this piece for a minute, in 2010, the national undercount for renters was 1.1%, and if you recall the $76 million in Medicaid funding that even a 1% undercount can have. Based on this 2010 experience, it's projected that in Minnesota, 15,000 renter households could be missed in the 2020 census. And this could cost the state as much as $23 million in lost federal funding each year for the next decade. People in rental housing are much more likely to live in multi-unit buildings, which are difficult for census workers to access when they're trying to follow up in person to non-responding households. So in close, we have a real opportunity. The federal census is having many challenges. They had a leadership change. They haven't been fully funded to the level they need to be. So we have an opportunity to step up in Minnesota, make sure the census is done right. This is a bipartisan bill. We have seven Republican co-authors, including Representative Zerwas. We have support from urban and rural districts. We also have Governor Tim Walz's support, and he's included this in his budget. With that, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Bob Tracy, from the Minnesota Census Mobilization Project.
Thank you, Representative Long. Mr. Tracy, if you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Bob Tracy. In my professional life, I am Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Council on Foundations. Minnesota Council on Foundations is the convening group for the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership. The partnership is providing community-based leadership to create awareness and organize Minnesota to participate in the 2020 census. As you can see from this slide, On the left side, we have key partners, public sector partners. One is the Census Bureau, and let's be absolutely clear, the job of the Census is the job of the United States Census Bureau. They're the ones with the massive resources and the massive task of engaging our country in its largest civic mobilization outside of going to war. The Minnesota State Demographer's Office is our state's lead agent in this work. The Minnesota State Demographer's Office has many responsibilities assigned to it by the Census Bureau, but no dollars. So what you have before you today is a community-based proposal for looking at how we can best partner with the State Demographer's Office and how the state can best make its investment in a manner that coordinates our efforts to prepare Minnesota for the 2020 census. I'm going to take my few minutes here to give you an overview of generally why the census is important. For many of you, you probably already are aware of this. And then some specific reasons, and then finally why it's important for Minnesota in particular. And then finally, why the bill that's before you is of unique value to us.
If you could do that within 5 minutes or so, that'd be great.
I can do that in less than 5 minutes or so.
Can you name that song in 2 notes?
I can't do that if I keep getting these questions. It's in the Constitution. We need to do it right. But the census is also important because it's the way we allocate power and influence in our communities. It's about dollars. Public dollars, not just the federal dollars, but every one of you use the census data to allocate precious state dollars. It's about small d democracy. I was in Wilmer yesterday meeting with a group of citizens about the census, and they were very, very clear about how important this data was for each of their localities to make smart decisions. They were also really clear that they wouldn't have had a coal store in their community if they didn't have good census data. So as much as they appealed to vendors and companies to come into their community, at the end of the day, the decision was made based upon census data. I use Target as the example here only because they're one of our largest members. I should note members of the Minnesota Council on Foundations include corporate giving programs, community foundations, and private foundations. But let's look at some of those specific reasons for Minnesota, and I appreciate Representative Long highlighting the apportionment and redistricting issue. If the census were held today, we would be at number 437, but if population trends continued as they have been in 2020, we would be at 434. We are so defining the nature of what it means to be on the bubble. So any one of you who does anything to promote participation in the census, if we get to 2021 and Minnesota still has 8 congressional districts, we all get to say, and I made that happen. I do want to update some information that Representative Long shared with you, and this is really only a few weeks old. Nationally, $833 billion is allocated based upon census data. The estimate now updated is that $15.5 billion comes into Minnesota every year based upon census data. So that's a significant increase over the data that we had to work with previously. And finally, I want to highlight the issue of this being our first high-tech census. The Census Bureau is expecting to have 60% of the responses this time through some electronic device. That's great. Census Bureau is in the 21st century, but it creates tremendous challenges for us in communities that have broadband access issues. And for every community, we have to know whether or not we're ready. Is the Census Bureau fully developed this infrastructure? Is it fully tested? Are the data privacy protections in place, and will people be familiar with it? We have a lot of work to do to engage people in this first high-tech census. And the final thing I want to draw to your attention in terms of Minnesota-specific information, there are many resources out there to help us identify how to target our efforts to engage historically undercounted communities. But one of the most valuable is looking at what the response rate was in 2010. And Representative Long indicated that Minnesota did a really good job. We were good Minnesotans. 81% of us, as soon as we got the postcard, filled out the census form. So that means we only have 19% of the population that we really have to double down on and help them count. But reaching that 19% is the most expensive part of the work. If you look at this map, you'll also see the geographic distribution of where some of those harder-to-reach populations are. And very generally speaking, looking at those lighter counties, our greatest challenges are in the geographic areas of the state that are basically Brainerd Lakes North. So we really need to be working in those areas. So let me talk then just a little bit about what is in the bill. The bill has a provision to provide funding to reach those hard-to-reach dwellings. The Census Bureau does not mail to P.O. boxes. We want to make sure we mail the P.O. boxes, and especially in Greater Minnesota, so that everyone is aware of what's going to be coming before them on April 1st, 2020. Richer households, as Representative Long has indicated, present unique challenges, and so the bill both provides a policy provision that applies essentially the same multifamily access privileges that go to candidates for elected office to census workers in Minnesota. But more importantly, it includes funding to educate dwelling owners and residents. So the $2.5 million request in front of you includes these provisions to engage hard-to-reach dwellings. It includes some special outreach efforts that are really based on helping people become familiar with this, our first digital census. It includes organizing an outreach to engage historically undercounted communities. The one thing I want to highlight in that is the Census Bureau hires a lot of people. Those become the enumerators. Those people need to be reflective of their communities, though, and the Census Bureau is having a very, very hard time identifying people in this economy, but they're not doing a great job of recruiting people. And so the state is saying we actually need to double down and do our own outreach to make sure that people get to these jobs. And finally, the bill provides providing for shared services, economy of scale, so that every community isn't going out and creating their own translation services, but they have access to a one-stop shop through the state demographer's office. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that concludes my overview, and I know that Representative Long and I would love to respond to questions.
Sure. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I'll turn to member questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering, will the same address constraints and residency, address constraints that are used for our, voting be used for the census?
Mr. Tracy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Census Bureau has its own system for identifying addresses that will be contacted for the purpose of the census. The process is called the LUCA program. So in 2017 through March 2018, the Census Bureau reached out to every state asking them to update their address list. With funding that was provided by the legislature in 2017, the state demographer's office was actually able to work with every county to help them update their current address list and get that into the LUCA system. For those smaller counties that didn't have the staff to do that, then the state demographer's office was able to go in and help them do that. So for the first time, Minnesota has had 100% participation in the LUCA program. But the Census Bureau uses its own data collection system because not every state is able to offer a reliable or similar address management system. So every state goes through the process of collecting their addresses and reporting them through the Census Bureau's own LUCA program.
Ms. Quam. Thank you, Mr. Chair. While that was informative, that did not answer the question. We will soon, as a legislature, be utilizing the census data in order to do our redistricting within the state. And I was trying to ascertain, because we had recent testimony about certain forms of addresses are not considered appropriate for locating for voting purposes. In fact, there was court action in recent years on that. I'm trying to have an idea of the delta between what the census data has and what our state as a determination for being able to vote in a precinct or area, what that delta is.
I don't know if the testifier is familiar with election law to the extent we are. It might be helpful background. I mean, I assume Representative Kwame might be asking about P.O. boxes, because I know we talked about that a couple days ago in this committee.
And business addresses being utilized, and yes, and especially since they mentioned P.O. boxes specifically for distributing, how inaccurate will that data in the census be compared to you know, us when we do our redistricting plans?
Sure.
Chair Farber, Representative Kwame.
Yeah, Representative
Long. Neither of us know the answer. The state demographer was planning to be here today, but unfortunately had to travel for work. But we will be in touch with her and try to relay your question and have her get back to you in the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it would be very good for this committee to have that understanding, and then, you know, staff, at least probably, you know, nonpartisan staff will have that information, so when it comes up the next term, that we have it. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Plum. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first off, I just want to say thank you to my colleagues on the other side, too, for you know, supporting this bill. Representative Zerwals, Representative Heinrich, and Representative Lehman. And to our testifier, I just saw one point in your presentation. You said 2010 there was a 19% uncounted. Can you give us an idea what that 19% impact if we may potentially have gotten another congressional seat or not?
Mr. Tracy.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to be clear that 19% was the non-response rate. So that's the rate of people who did not respond upon first contact from the Census Bureau. Minnesota in 2010 actually ended up having statistically virtually an accurate account. But within that overall accurate account, there was overcounting in some communities and undercounting in others. The undercounting tended to be in lower income communities or among lower income households and in rural geographic areas. But the state does not get a level of detail from the Census Bureau to help us fully articulate what that undercount is. We only understand it with some generalities.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up, can you tell us, you know, what are your group doing to reach out to our veterans around these issues? And I'm just, you know, just to provide context, last year I served on the Veterans Committee, and I found out that, you know, the count of veterans and, you know, just our census count impacts how many beds are allocated to us at the federal level with regards to some of our veterans' home. And so I really wanted to know, what are you doing so that we could, you know, get a good count, and so that when we're allocated beds for our veterans' home, we could actually get, you know, the highest amount that we can get to serve all the veterans who are in the state.
Mr. Tracy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your question highlights how it is we are trying to coordinate our efforts between the Census Bureau, the State Demographer's Office, and the Census Mobilization Project's community-based efforts. The Census Bureau has a fully developed program for reaching out to veterans. We're not going to duplicate that. We will support their effort as they need that. In comparison, the Census Mobilization Partnership, we know that the Census Bureau has a very difficult time reaching historically undercounted communities in Minnesota. So, for example, we have some new immigrant populations in Minnesota that are significant to our state, but not nationally significant. So the Census Bureau is not set up to do that. So we're focusing our state efforts there, again, so that we don't duplicate but instead complement what the Census Bureau is doing in their efforts.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final comment. Just want to say thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill forward, and I think that's so crucial for us when we think about the federal aid that we get in the state of Minnesota. So I just want to say thank you for this.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, this is, again, on the people that use post office boxes. And I know we've had the court case, so people that, for instance, live on reservations, people that are victims or survivors of domestic abuse. So maybe just a little bit more detail on how they're being covered.
Sure. Brief answer, Mr. Tracy. We have a few more members on the list and a few more bills.
Mr. Chair, I could use a little clarification on the question, though.
Okay. Representative Mason, further clarification?
All I'm trying to do is just make sure that we have the right information about people who use post office boxes and may not have alternatives, such as the court. I know the reservations were in the courts, but people that are victims of domestic abuse also use post office boxes.
Mr. Tracy.
And so, Mr. Chair, thank you for restating the question. And again, it is getting into a level of detail where I'm not familiar. That really is something that having the state demographer respond to. So both of those issues, Representative Qualms and yours, Representative Mason, we're happy to work with the state demographer and with the committee staff to get a response to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks so much, Representative Long, for bringing this forward. I just wanted to share a little bit about what I think this will do for my district. I actually was I was an enumerator during the last census in 2010, and I worked right in the community where I live, which is now, you know, the community that I'm here working for. And as I'm bilingual, and so I was kind of dispatched particularly to households where someone who spoke Spanish and there wasn't an English speaker present had been identified. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just want to, before I worked for the census, I didn't really realize what an undertaking it is. I mean, you know, you talk about 15% of people don't respond to, to the initial census form that gets mailed out. And so, you know, as our testifier and Representative Long have identified, I mean, these are disproportionately, people who are difficult to reach, people who maybe don't have an English speaker in the household, who are immigrants, refugees, people of color. And one thing that I encountered was that when you're working for the census and you go to a home, you are encountering people's mistrust of the government, right, up close and personal. And so you have to kind of be able to help them understand what the census does and the kind of the separations that are in place between the Census Bureau and other units of government. And for me, the fact that in 2010 there was a real concerted effort to create really strong partnerships with trusted community organizations that have pre-existing relationships in those communities that are historically difficult to count was so valuable, because there were sort of like marketing campaigns in the different languages in the community where I was working that the messages were coming from people from organizations with whom residents had a pre-existing relationship. And so it made it easier to go and make the case that, you know, if you answer these few questions, you're actually helping us to do this important work, right? That we have to do in order to make decisions about resource allocation and other really important things. So what I've heard from, because since I worked in the census, now I kind of like have friends who are involved in that world, is that we're behind. We are massively behind in this effort compared to where we were around the 2010 census. Funds aren't coming through on the schedule that we need them. There's a much smaller pot of money that's being devoted to these marketing campaigns, to these investments in nonprofits that are doing this work. And so You know, and it's pretty scary to think about what the implications of that might be, especially since, as we've talked about, you know, we have a congressional seat in the balance. So, and just the last thing that I wanted to say specifically about my district is that, and I think we all kind of, you know, we're door knockers. Yeah, I'm working on it. We're door knockers, right, because we run for office, and so we know about trying to gain access to small apartment buildings and how difficult that can be. There are a lot of these in my district, 4 to 20-unit apartment buildings. Many of them are owned by, you know, not by big companies that manage a lot of units, but by an individual maybe who doesn't have the information that they need to understand what their obligations are in terms of allowing access to a census enumerator that shows up. And so I'm really thankful to see those two things really lifted up in this legislation. You know, the partnerships with organizations that serve underrepresented communities and really like focusing on counting renters and making sure that enumerators can have access to those apartment buildings that they need access to. So thank you so much, Representative Long.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question might be for the author of the testifier. I'm not quite sure, but I was just wondering on under the access required, it says at 1.14 and 1.15, an employee granted access under this section must be permitted to leave census materials for residents at their doors. My concern here, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but I feel like if the intent is awareness and education, I'm guessing through print materials, is it in fact, does that employee just have to leave that material at the door, or is there? Can you actually knock on the door and try to engage that person face-to-face? Because that's not, I don't see that specifically. Kind of the way it reads, it says leave census materials for residents at the door.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Heinrich. And I apologize, I didn't mention at the beginning your support for the bill, and I appreciate that a lot. And I forgot to mention Representative Layman's support as well. So thank you both. So this is modeled exactly after the statute that allows for access for candidates. And so it does allow access for the census enumerators to speak to the individuals. This is an additional provision that would allow folks to be leaving materials at the door. And the goal is really just to make sure that there wouldn't be a kind of effort to, you know, say you have to put all the materials in one spot and then folks wouldn't have access to them. There is a provision. There are separate provisions for nursing homes, et cetera, where you may not be able to go door to door in certain circumstances where there are health or safety issues.
Okay. Jim Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Long.
Okay. I have no other members on the list. Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Long?
No, I just really appreciate the committee's attention to this matter.
Okay, thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1644 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way.
Thank you, committee members.
Yes, thank you. Representative Lippert, I believe. You were up next, and there's a testifier who had some urgency time-wise. So I will, while Representative Lippert comes down here, I will move that House File 1267 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Lippert, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Currently, the Department of Agriculture has an organic advisory task force that's been in place since 2003, and it's comprised of a broad array of stakeholders in the organic agriculture industry, and it advises both the Commissioner of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota on all things pertaining to the organic agriculture industry. This task force does good work, and periodically it needs to be renewed. So what this bill does is extend the work of the Organic Advisory Task Force through 2024. And with me is James Riddle, who's the current chair of the Organic Advisory Task Force, can say a few words about the task force, what they do, and the work that's ahead of them. And Bruce Miller is also here with the Minnesota Farmers Union to share his support for the work of this task force, too.
Okay. And I understand that I need to amend my motion, is that correct, to refer to Ways and Means Committee? Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not certain if there's a fiscal note attached to this bill, but usually when you extend a task force, there is a fiscal cost. So
I will make that motion then. Representative Lippert?
There is a fiscal note with the bill.
Yes, then it should go to Ways and Means. So I will amend my motion to refer it to the Ways and Means. Okay, and Mr. Riddle, would you like to go first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Riddle, Blue Fruit Farm, Winona, Minnesota, and I do currently serve as chair of the state's Organic Advisory Task Force. And just for your information, organic remains the fastest growing sector of food and agriculture with sales of $47 billion in the U.S. in 2017. And we want to make sure that Minnesota producers, retailers, processors are actively taking part in this fast-growing market. But also, these are producers who protect water quality, build soil health, protect biodiversity, sequester carbon, and are able to participate in a profitable sector of agriculture. And under statute, we do provide advice to both the Department of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota. And some of the areas where our upcoming work plan will be concentrated if we are reauthorized is implementing the 2018 Farm Bill, making sure that the provisions that could impact Minnesota, that we are actively tracking how those are enforced. We also, at the state of Minnesota, have a transition cost share program to help conventional farmers, beginning farmers, enter the organic marketplace. We want to make sure that that program is well known and that there's outreach in the agriculture sector so that especially conventional beginning farmers know that there is assistance to help them successfully enter into organic transition. We also listen to the concerns of Minnesota's organic producers. We are required to meet at least twice a year, but we can meet up to four times a year. All of our meetings are open to the public, and we do take input from anyone who shows up. We also have a broad stakeholder representation, as you see in the bill, so it's not just farmers, but also processors, retailers, scientists, etc., at the table. Some of the concerns right now before us, we're currently importing about 70% of the organic soybeans used in the United States and about 40 to 50% of the organic corn. That opens up the potential for fraud because some of this grain is coming through Turkey, Ukraine, Russia, and is of questionable. So we have taken positions asking our federal representatives to look into that, and the 2018 Farm Bill strengthens some enforcement provisions to help crack down on that potential. But what I see, that represents a huge opportunity for Minnesota farmers, because if there's anything you can grow organically in Minnesota, it's corn and beans. So we will help with that. We also help identify research priorities for the University of Minnesota. And the 2018 Farm Bill increased the Federal Organic Research and Extension Initiative funding from $20 million a year to $50 million a year. University of Minnesota is a leader in organic research. We have over 1,000 acres certified organic in five different locations, including 150-head organic dairy herd at Morris. When the Organic Advisory Task Force identifies research priorities, then the researchers can take that information, build it into their grant proposals, and that really strengthens their competitiveness for these federal grants. So we really can help get more of that dollars back to Minnesota, but also help meet the needs of Minnesota's organic producers. We also provide input on the mandatory, statutory required status report on organic agriculture that's required to be submitted by the department to the legislature every 5 years, and that will be coming up in 2020. Minnesota is unique in that our Department of Ag is the only state that organizes an annual organic conference. Our task force members are involved as volunteers, as speakers, and helping shape the content of that annual conference, which was very popular, very well attended in January in St. Cloud every year. So I thank you for having a bill to reauthorize and urge the, moving it forward. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Did you care to speak as well? If so, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bruce Miller with Minnesota Farmers Union. I'm going to be very brief, but I want the committee to know that this is the kind of legislation that has our support. Agriculture in Minnesota, as some of you have heard me say many times already, is a big tent. And in that tent, there are various segments. One of them is the organic agricultural segment. It's an important and growing segment in Minnesota. And this bill extending the advisory task force works because there's still work to do. When we appeared in front of another committee, the questions were, what about false organics or fake organics? And you've heard Mr. Riddle address that somewhat. There's more work for this task force to do to continue to build organic agriculture in the state of Minnesota and for them to be up under this big tent of agriculture as one segment of the whole agricultural picture in the state of Minnesota. An important segment and one that we can support, and we urge you to extend the task force for the 5 years to advise the University of Minnesota, to advise the Department of Agriculture, and to contribute to the fabric of agriculture in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yep. And any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Sauk.
I was just curious, thank you, Mr. Chair, if your organization or some organization essentially certifies the issue of is it organic or not. I think one of the values in organic is that it's perceived to have value, but that value will quickly just dissipate or disappear as soon as any question it comes up relative to the credibility of the declaration. So I think you know what I'm getting at.
Mr. Riddle. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's why the organic community went to Congress in 1990 and asked to be regulated so that we have one standard and a legal definition of organic. And that was fully implemented in 2002. I served on the National Organic Standards Board at that time that advises USDA on implementation. But I also, besides being a producer, was an organic inspector for 20 years because I want to make sure that the customer is getting what they're paying for, and the farmers who are paying the rules aren't competing with fraudulent producers. And so we have the term organic defined in federal law. It's the certifications are done by federally accredited certification bodies. So in Minnesota, there are private bodies that are regulated by USDA that are then authorized to send their inspectors, gather the paperwork, and enforce and compliance. And if there are large-scale fraud, then those are prosecuted by the U.S. Department of Justice. And there have been significant prosecutions, fines, and even jail time for committing organic fraud. But I'm totally committed to that, and that's another role of the task force. If we hear of things, suspicions, we're a place where the public can bring those, turn them around, and make sure that they're properly investigated. Sometimes it's a fraudulent complaint where it's a neighbor who's jealous, so it doesn't have merit. But other times, based on evidence, there can be prosecutions. But the day-to-day certification is done by the accredited certification bodies who are regulated by USDA.
Representative Sell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. I don't have any other members on the list. So seeing none, I will renew my motion. Or I'm sorry, Representative Lippert, did you have any closing remarks?
I support this moving forward and ask for your vote. Thanks.
Okay. I will move that House File 1267, renew my motion that House File 1267 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Your bill is on its way, Representative Lippert. Representative Hansen. I will move that House File 1587 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. If you could please present your bill, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. If you look through House File 1587, the change is on line 2.21. It's extending the Budget Oversight Committee 5 years. And this is a committee that of citizens representing a variety of groups that look over the various license fees, whether they're deer or pheasant or small game. They do good work. They produce a report, which we can make available to you if you'd like, and I'd like your support to continue this.
Thank you. Is there anybody who would like to speak on House File 1587? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I was just wondering if this if this oversight committee has the ability to rescind or deny decisions made by the DNR or reverse decisions made by the DNR.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, no, it is advisory only.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Hansen.
Appreciate your support.
Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 1587 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Lilly, appreciate your patience, even though you are on the committee. You presumably would have been here anyway. So, I will move that. No, wait, I guess you can do that since you're on the committee. So I think this was going to
Mr. waste. Chair, will you move it, please?
Sure.
And, I'll move. And the amendment?
Yep, I'll move that House File 1863 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I understand you have an A1 amendment. Is that to put it in the shape you would like it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank I will you. Move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like it. Please present your bill, Representative Lilly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1863 is a bit of a Band-Aid bill that it would appropriate money to pay the salaries and benefits of the employees just in case the budget wasn't fully funded for the legislature and an entire budget for that we put forth you know, as a legislature. So for the new biennium, and so this would fully fund the effort of our team, our staff around the state. This happened a couple years ago. We had a shutdown, and in 2005 we had a shutdown. In 2010, and we had one of the longest shutdowns in the country. And if you recently had the opportunity to see what went on in with the federal government, there was a shutdown. And so the intent of this bill is to keep things running, unlike what happened at the federal government or even with us as a state, and to keep things kind of running. And this would impact originally the reason for the amendment. Originally, it was a bit of an oversight, so I want to apologize to some of our staff in the legislature because and some others were exempted. So this would cover all employees throughout the state and basically keep things running while us as politicians figure out how to move forward and get our business done and get it to the governor and signed. So again, the intent is basically these folks take on full-time employment, and so we need to treat them with you know, being part of our toolbox, our helpers that are implementing the laws that we pass here, and we need to treat them with respect and as we would any employer or employee, rather. If you worked for a major company, most people when they go to work for them expect that they would be you know, working steady and straight through. Imagine the stress that these employees go through as they face these budget, you know, our negotiation. So every year or every time this goes through, they're facing these concerns. You know, I'm a little more comfortable in my economic personal life now that, you know, but there has been times where money was tighter, and and I'm very sympathetic to that. And I just can't imagine if someone has to pay rent, car payments, repairs, et cetera, et cetera. So just the fear, the unknown, and the stress related to that. So essentially this would keep funding our entire team around the whole state, and that's the intent. I guess I know we're impacted with some time constraints here, so I'll kind of wrap it up. I have with me today one of our state employees, and she was, my understanding, was impacted by what happened in 2011, mm-hmm. and would be willing to tell the committee kind of the story of how and what happens in real life, what this does to some of our employees. So, Mr. Chair, if you will.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. If you could please start by stating your name and then proceed with your testimony, and thank you for your patience in waiting through the other bills.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kelly Christensen, and I have I've been a Minnesota Department of Transportation employee for 9 years. I've been a state employee for 12. I come here today in support of House File 1863. In order to understand why I currently support this bill, it is important to take a walk in time with me to understand some important Minnesota events that are now a part of our state's collective history. I was a MnDOT employee the summer of 2011. The particular summer was memorable to me, and unfortunately the memories are not ones I want to repeat. I refer to the summer of 2011 as the year as I and thousands of other state employees were used as pawns in a political tactic game. In other words, I was laid off for 3 weeks, I was not allowed to work, and I was not able to collect my regular paycheck for 20 days when our state legislative leaders and governor could not agree on how to balance the budget. In addition, my salary and many coworkers' salaries were used as a strategic tool to try to make a point. The unease of not knowing when I would get paid or be able to go back to work and do my job caused me considerable stress and anxiety because there was literally nothing I could do to change the situation. I remember crying in a coworker's arms a few days before the shutdown happened and asking her why we had to go through this. And she hugged me and just said she had no idea. I remember watching the news every day during the shutdown and wondering, is this the day our elected leaders would finally come to an agreement? As one individual who's gone through this type of experience, I can tell you it's one of the most frustrating and maddening experiences to be used as a bargaining chip in a game of who can blink first, to use state employees' salaries for anything other than a means to pay employees who want to work should not be allowed to occur ever again in state government. To use completely innocent lives in something as important as their paychecks or livelihoods as a political strategy is immoral, uncalled for, and should be unthinkable. To inflict completely unnecessary financial pain throughout the state should be a completely archaic practice never to be used again in state government. At the conclusion of the 20 days in 2011, this was the longest government shutdown in our country's history. Is this the type of history we want for our great state of Minnesota? I certainly don't. The practice of withholding paychecks in this manner is completely unheard of in the private sector and any other sector other than government, and it's time we put an end to this. The summer of 2011's memories are never far from my mind when May of odd number years roll around. The legislature usually comes down to the wire in completing their tasks. But I'm always wondering the last several days is this going to be another repeat of the summer of 2011? Let's fast forward to December of 2018 and January of 2019 and examine the national events of our country. Our country embarked on the longest federal government shutdown in its history. I couldn't help but compare the federal shutdown to the state shutdown we experienced in 2011. At the national level, there were many congressional leaders on both sides of the political spectrum that were quoted as saying they were not in favor of shutting down the government as a political tactic and that using people's livelihoods and salaries as a tactic to prove a point was immoral and ineffective at best. Frankly, I was shocked when a bill passed that would allow federal employees to receive back pay when the shutdown was over. I was shocked because this was completely unheard of in 2011 for us as state employees. I was completely supportive of the move, but wondered why myself as a state employee did not receive the same treatment in 2011. Am I worth less than a federal employee? It feels pretty demoralizing and degrading when I see support of federal employees, but my own state currently doesn't have the same type of support currently in place. I want you to consider this. If every legislator and governor completes their assigned task every year and balances the budget, which includes appropriations for state employee salaries, this bill will cost our state nothing. Zero. If there's a question in your mind on if you should vote for this bill, let me ask you this. As a legislator, do you ever have to worry about your paycheck getting withheld for an irrelevant reason? The answer to that is no. Why should myself or thousands of other employees be subjected to dehumanizing treatment of using state employee salaries as bargaining chips? Please make this practice a thing of the past and part of our state's history once and for all. Please vote in favor of House File 1863.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Christensen. Representative Lilly, did you have a comment?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Christensen. I just wanted to make a comment, and then I'm going to have someone from the engineers say a few words, but I just wanted to state that there's bipartisan support in the Senate. My intent really is not to have this be a partisan issue. It's really it's a good government. It's how you would want to be treated as, you know, as an employee. But there's bipartisan support in the Senate, and my apologies to the my friends on the GOP side, because I gathered signatures quickly and threw it in the hopper. So there may have been some that would have signed on here too if I had reached out and made the effort. But sure. I have someone here from the engineers, and he'd like to say a few words if that's possible.
Sure, and they still can sign on if they would like to. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Korduski, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Government Engineers Council. We're a 1,000-member union of engineers, surveyors, and engineering staff working in various agencies within state government. I happen to be vice president of this union. I'm testifying today in support of House File 1863. First, there's the obvious financial burden put on my members, and as well as the financial burden put on other state employees by state government shutdown. House File 1863 provides salaries and benefits to those employees in the event of a shutdown. There are other costs associated with a government shutdown that you may not be aware of, and I believe House File 1863 will create the chances that a special master will deem some state employees essential in the event of a shutdown scenario. I'm a construction engineer, and I oversee roadway and bridge projects here in the metro area. I'm aware of these costs. I'm aware of costs that were a direct result of the 2011 shutdown. For example, in 2011, there was a looming state government shutdown, and state construction engineers were faced with preparing these active projects and associated work zones for an inactive construction period of unknown duration. On many projects, safety measures were taken, roadway striping was refreshed, and ultimately, these projects prepared for the shutdown. During that shutdown, state employees were laid off, construction activities stopped, construction contractors demobilized equipment, and some even laid off employees. After the three-week shutdown, construction engineers were faced with evaluating the construction projects and determining how to complete those projects. On some projects, contractors were paid overtime and accelerated the work to try to make up for that lost time as a result of the shutdown. On other projects, contractors were compensated for the delay of that 3 weeks in extending the project completion date because of the shutdown. Contractors were paid for remobilizing equipment, also paid material costs and some additional labor costs. In total, $36 million in additional costs were paid to construction contractors in the preparation for the shutdown and the recovery of that three-week government shutdown that occurred in 2011 statewide. What project in your district could have been built for that $36 million? In addition, the traveling public drove through these inactive work zones during the 2011 shutdown. It's pretty common for a construction work zone to have reduced lanes, reduced capacity, and provide congestion to the traveling public. The government shutdown delayed roadway and bridge projects, and increased the cost to society that drive through these congested work zones, and road user costs can be significant. For example, in 2016, I oversaw a project just east of here on I-94 from Mounds Boulevard to Century Avenue. In that summer of 2016, the project reduced westbound I-94 from 3 lanes to 2 lanes for about a 100-day period. The computed road user costs for additional delay, not the delay commuters see every day, but the additional delay from going from 3 lanes to 2 for 100 days was $6.4 million in road user costs. Now, fortunately, in 2016, we weren't in the government shutdown scenario, but you can just imagine, right, a future shutdown, all the projects statewide, right, and depending on the congestion, the status of those projects, those road user costs are real. So I guess in passing House File 1863, right, we can avoid these additional costs paid to the contractors, additional costs for road users that are, right, these are your constituents. And I think passing House File 1863 provides salaries and benefits to state employees and likely increases the chances that a special master will rule that some state employees are essential and keep our infrastructure projects going. Avoid these additional costs. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 1863? Okay, seeing none, member discussion, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if my recollection is correct, the definition of essential was extremely narrow. I believe previous governors such as Pawlenty, when there was road construction that was started, he allowed that road construction to continue. In other words, the executive branch had extreme power in defining what was essential and not. Hours before the end of the shutdown in 11, the present governor at that time was in a public meeting, and I happened to be sitting next to him, and I asked him why food banks were not considered essential. Because if you remember, food banks were not being able to function. So this bill, will that take away some of that broad executive decision of what's essential and not? Because that made a difficult situation worse. And so I'm trying to understand the full capacity at which this bill will alleviate all of the difficulties and complexities that were happening at that time.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. It was just brought to my attention, maybe Mr. Guerin can spread some light on this, but I think some of that's decided by the courts, actually, and wasn't or is not decided by the governor. But my intent is that we'll keep things running and with this bill, and as we fight it out as politicians, we do our business in, you know, but the business of the state continues. Food shelves, our roads and bridges are continuing, you know, our season's short enough in Minnesota already, much less shutting it down for 3 weeks and so on. Anyways, I don't want to get into that, but my intent is that it keeps it running. But Mr. Gehring or maybe the chair.
Mr. Chair, since there's a difference between, and I think there are very few years in between those two shutdowns, the two governors had huge differences in how they defined what was, you know, I could have seen if later on it was looser because the courts said, hey, these are included, but it was more constrained. And, you know, I thought I detected a nod from the engineer indicating that Pawlenty did allow road projects that were being started. So instead of totally shutting it down, there was that flexibility in the definition. And, you know, frankly, if we pass legislation to fix this, then the courts shouldn't need to be involved because we'll have it fixed. there won't be any gray areas, any slippy, slidey, ways to weasel around it. We'll have it done right. And if we're going to do this bill, I just wanted to be more assured that it's tight enough so we don't have some of those problems of where, someone can have the discretion to make it more painful.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and members, and a huge apology. My bill, actually, the employees are paid, so things do actually continue to shut down until we get our things. So there is a major difference, and I was wrong about what I had said. So
I would, assume that since they're getting paid, there's no need to decide who's essential and who isn't.
Correct.
At that point, yeah. Representative Kwong?
Mr. Chair, what I tried to get across was it goes beyond just direct state employees that are affected, and it was touched upon by the engineer that testified. And if we're going to fix this problem, let's make sure that we do as comprehensive as we can, because a lot of the people affected are beyond, I think, what the scope is, and that was the intent to bring this topic up.
Representative Lilly?
Mr. Chair, I think we're fine.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe I probably have a question for Mr. Gehring. Subdivision 5, a later appropriation, would you just help us figure out what that means?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, so Subdivision 5, I think, from my understanding of this bill, is intended to clarify that once the if there is a lapse in appropriations for a biennium, state employees would be funded under this bill, and then once the legislature and the governor then agree on a state budget, then whatever is agreed in that budget would then supersede this section. So if there's an increase or decrease to a particular agency in the legislatively enacted budget, then that those amounts would be what would apply going forward. So that's what that Subdivision 5 is saying, is that further enacted budget laws would supersede this requirement that employees get paid.
Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gehring, and probably Representative Lilly, is the expectation that folks will still continue to work?
Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tice. My clarification here at the end was that they would be paid. So, no, they would, unfortunately, government would probably be shut down. And while we work out our differences, but the employers, our team, would be paid. The non-essential apparently decided by the courts. I would argue that all of our team's essential, myself, but I don't think that's what the courts would say.
Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the federal level, a lot of folks, the TSA especially, did continue to work, and so that's why I'm a little bit confused about what was going on, because another question was, if they are going to continue to work, do we have appropriations for keeping the offices, the occupancies expense going as well? So I'm just trying to figure it out. Thank you.
I think we have somebody here who could speak to this. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. So these workers would continue to be laid off just as they were in previous shutdowns. That's not a continuation of the work that's being done. This is to make up for the salary that they don't get paid when the government shuts down, and that they actually do suffer loss in salary and benefits during that period of time. So if the governor or the court's special master issued a decision to say that workers for all of military affairs were essential and that they needed, or all of the employees up at the Department of Administration who work with the leases in different agency buildings were essential, then they would continue to do that.
Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little confused, but maybe we can just talk later.
Okay.
Rather than taking committee time.
Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, your intention is to appropriate money to all state employees, and then have those individuals not work?
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, no, I mean, personally, I would hope they'd be working, but, I mean, they're dependent on us getting our work done and getting signed by the governor and put into law. So there is a possibility that they could be home, but this would alleviate the stress of our employees waiting for us to finish our deal, which hopefully doesn't happen again.
Representative Zerwas.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair, and I guess because of the amendment that Representative Lilly added to the bill, which would allow legislators to continue getting paid during a government shutdown, I'll ask members to oppose this bill, and I'll ask for a roll call.
Representative Lilly, roll call's been requested. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, just a bit of a clarification. I've lived through one of these, and we were paid anyways. I gave my money to the church that I go to, so if you go, Tom Hauser does a list of who received a check, I received a check. So this isn't for us. I think we're arguably essential. This is for our teammates, the gentlemen sitting in front of you, our House research staff that are going to actually be working, trying to put the deal together with the governor, and nonpartisan, and this is other employees. So I find it a little unfortunate that you turn this into a political thing, but, you know, go ahead, ask for the roll call, and I think I can hold my head high, and I would be surprised that you wouldn't have concern for the employees of the state.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. When you're listening to the national shutdown, the fact that so many of the employees had trouble getting jobs during the interim because employers knew that they'd be going back to their federal jobs once it was over. So it places our, in this case, state employees at an incredible disadvantage, and it's not to mention undue stress because the governor and the legislator couldn't get their job done. I mean, that to me is just really difficult, but just watching what took place at the national level should illustrate that we need to be doing something. So I think Representative Lilly's is what, you know, I just really, really appreciate it. And then another comment, I remember listening to somebody from MnDOT just telling how much money they were going to have to use for postage to tell people about the fact that they weren't going to be able to finish projects. I mean, there was so much money that is wasted, but the best we could do at least is to make sure that the least amount of harm is done to our state employees. So again, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Just want to say thank you, Representative Lilly, for bringing this forward and to the testifier, especially Ms. Christensen. Thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, when you brought up the federal shutdown, my sister was actually one of the, you know, employee who went through that. She worked for the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, just hearing her story about how she has to, you know, go to the bank and the devastation she was feeling just to ask her mortgage lender to see if she could take a deferral for her mortgage. And, you know, me being an elected official here in the Minnesota State Legislature, knowing that I cannot, you know, do anything in my capacity to help that, but making a commitment to her and to the employees of the state of Minnesota that we will be doing our part to help you out so that, you know, at the end of the day, you do not have to be put into that situation that you were put in back in 2011 into the situation that was happening at the federal level earlier this year, too. And so I just want to say thank you for sharing that with all of us. And it is like you said, you know, if we are doing our job, then we don't have to worry about, you know, who is getting paid or who is not getting paid. And so just want to say thank you both for testifying and Representative Lilly for bringing this forward.
Any additional member discussion? Okay, yeah. Oh, what? Representative Derwas?
We'll withdraw the roll call.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Derwas. Yes, and I would just add, you know, my sister worked, I think it was during the 2011 shutdown, maybe it was an earlier one, but she worked for the Department of Human Services. Now she's with MnDOT, where you are, Ms. Christensen. But, yeah, no, she had to take up a job. You know, she's got three kids. She had to take up a job waiting tables during the shutdown. So this is something that affects a lot of people very personally. So the roll call's been requested. Oh, any closing remarks, Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know this has been a long hearing today on other issues, and then I'm adding to it. But this is very important. I've been here a while, and one of the advantages is one of my favorite things to do is listen to retirement speeches. And I have not heard a retirement speech where people don't start with thanking our staff and realizing the talent that we have throughout this building. And I mean that sincerely. And I know that all of us could not do our jobs with the people in this building. Well, it's the same in with our engineers and our same in MnDOT and beyond. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing me.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1863, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The bill's on its way. Just to wrap up this meeting, there is a referral memo in members' packets, so you might want to take a look at that. We're meeting tomorrow, Friday, at 10:15 in the morning. Are we in this room? We're in some room. It's on the schedule. Oh, room 5. There it is. Right. Representative Derwas, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have insight into Monday's schedule? I know that there was a room reservation in the evening and saw that some bills got referred to this committee. Just wondering on timing. Some of us towards the very end of the alphabet may have a commitment from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And would prefer not to have a committee meeting over that time period.
I will see what I can do. We will likely have a hearing on Monday. We have several bills up. I'll see if it appears possible to meet after. You said you're from 5:30 to 7, so that may mean that we would end up meeting at 7, but I won't commit to that at this point. But
thanks, sir.
don't blame me. Blame the governor.
I haven't committed to it yet, so I do want to check on that.
And, Mr. Chair, that may depend on how long session goes on Monday also.
I've thought of that, yes. Yeah. There's the potential for session also. So, yes, Representative.
And, Mr. Chair, it looks like the driver's license bill was referred to GovOps. Is that what you're looking at for Monday?
We're looking at it for next week. I think by the end of the day we will have Monday's calendar, Monday's schedule published. So, and you should know by the end of the day. So it should be well within 3 days in time for amendments. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.